Now, a caller says, morning, Greg. I spent a year working up in St. Bernadette's School, and I have to say the standard of education and social skills being taught up there is simply outstanding. The staff are amazing and the children just love it. It would be very sad to see it, to see anything change up there. Another caller says, when we visited mainstream secondary schools in the area to see what they could offer our child, one school told us she would remain outside the classroom on her own for 90% of the time, as they just didn't have children with special needs. Another school told us they had an autism unit only, that there was no place for children with other mild general learning issues. Another school had a limited space for children with issues. How are these schools to be ready for taking in children such as those and given them an equal or better learning experience in education than what they are already achieving in schools such as St. Bernadette's in the next year or so? It cannot happen. Children will suffer. There has been no consultation with parents on this. Yeah, that's a pretty good way of putting it there, I suppose. Another emailer says, mainstream was not working out for my child, especially in the last years of primary school when the focus is really academic and on sporting achievements. St. Bernadette's School is equipped with resources for children with mild general learning disability. There are structured routines, small classes suited to children with sensory issues. The school environment is tailored to the children's needs. The teachers and educators have trained in cognitive learning disabilities and special education specifically. Our child transferred from mainstream to St. Bernadette School for her secondary education and has proved to be transformative for her. She's just completed 2 years in St. Bernadette School and has made fantastic progress. The school is truly amazing. It's so clear that her and her classmates' needs are understood and prioritised, that she's among friends and classmates, her own peers. She has her individual lesson plan, junior cycle tailored to her and the other kids' needs. She's learning life skills. Her academic progress and her confidence has grown incredibly. A special class in a mainstream school cannot measure up in any way to this learning environment. Thank you for that. And, you know, I'm one of these people that listens to parents, listens to those most affected. And, you know, it is clear from these parents and their lived experiences with their children that they have great concerns about special classes in mainstream schools. More topics here. I'm sick and tired listening to the debate of the A5. It's been turned into a political football, as most things do. I've driven hundreds of thousands of miles on this road in cars, vans, lorries and coaches and haven't had one collision. I've witnessed many near misses, and in every case it was down to bad and aggressive drivers who tailgated and overtaked on blind bends. That comes in from time to time. This road is notorious. It's got all different types of traffic. It's got local traffic. It's got Donegal traffic. It's got traffic from other counties. It is clearly one of the most, if not the dangerous roads in Ireland. And it's the same drivers driving on all of these roads. So this has been going on too long and at too high an extent. You know, there are other people that have to come out onto the road, walk the road. You know, you need to think about it, this, if I can say respectfully, just a little bit more broadly. You know, I've driven on this road myself, and it's clearly evident that there are areas where it's problematic. You've got so much different traffic. You've got really bad bends, access out onto the road and so on and so forth. And as I say, it's the same drivers driving this road that drive every road in Ireland, yet this road is deadly. And there's been so many deaths and so many serious injuries as well. So, of course, I respect your view, but I just think evidently it might not just be the case. A caller says, refuel prices. How can prices shoot up already when most of the oil and petrol was already in the country? Petrol in my town went up 9 cents this morning from last night. This is simply price gouging. When is something going to be done to stop hard-pressed families facing these increases by greedy owners? We'll shop around. You know, you can get, in Letterkenny, for an example, you can get diesel. Let me just widen it out. You can get diesel for £1.58 or you can pay £1.77. So that is just on a poxy little litre. That's a difference of what, £1.58, 19 cent a litre. In terms of what you're saying about the petrol and diesel already being in this country, it doesn't quite work like that. But that being said, oil prices have dropped again now that Iran and Israel are in their ceasefire at the moment. So I don't know why prices went up so steeply around here. I do know that some hadn't increased them. It'll be interesting to see when they get next their next deliveries, do they increase them too? But I just have noticed that some prices have dropped up to the high 70s, whilst others are still able to charge the mid-60s or the end of the 50s. So I don't know. I try and understand, but sometimes I struggle. We've had loads of emails in as well, by the way, and I will be getting to those. In fact, I might just read this one now. Hi, Greg. Just an observation on some of the public areas around Letterkenny, and in particular, a few of the main approach roads into the town. In one word, they say, disgraceful. I refer in particular to what I consider to be probably the number one approach road into the town, the recently completed four-lane road from Clanry to Polestar Roundabout. What a shocking sight. There are thistles, dandelions, grass and numerous other types of weeds growing 3 to 4 foot high on the centre reservation alongside the ill-advised trees which have been planted there. Another road is the Ballyrane Road, which runs from Ballyrane Roundabout to what we still refer to as the Oatfield Roundabout. This, in and of itself, is a pretty road, which is also blighted by huge weeds and grass growing out of control alongside the trees. Just what impression do first-time visitors to Letterkenny get? If I were a first-time visitor, I'm pretty sure what my first impression would be. Do any of our many councillors or public reps travel these roads? I think the answer is probably a resounding yes. Are these people blind or just oblivious to this? Can none of them make a simple call to someone in the council in this regard? In 2015, we won the National Tidy Towns Award. I, for one, would be mortified if I were to accompany a Tidy Town rep around this town at present. Surely we can do better. That comes in from David, not a townie, but a long-time resident. And, you know, some people see that as nature and beauty, and some people see it as a mess. Letterkenny fared quite well in the recent Tidy Towns. I take your point. It's not really for me to say. Let's open it up to other listeners. Do you believe the approach roads in terms of weeds and out of control greenery is a blight on Letterkenny as you approach? Let me know. 086 60 25,000. Now, before the break, thank you to all the staff in Medical 5, from everyone, to the catering staff, to the nurses and the doctors. They provided me with great care. Please play Paul Wellis, You Do Something to Me. That comes in from John. Well, John, I can't play that, but the message is there. Happy 50th wedding anniversary to Teresa and Charles Ramsey in Newtown Cunningham, from their 6 children, 10 grandchildren and their great-granddaughter. Have a lovely day, Teresa and Charles. Abby Lee O'Brien's in Chestnut Grove in Lifford, and a very happy birthday to you, Abby Lee, from Granny and Granddad O'Brien. And if you want to get a request played at any stage during the show, but we generally have time just after the 10 o'clock news, feel free to text them in at any time, email them at any time, comments@highlandradio.com. We'll call them in the first hour and we'll include them just after 10. Right. AIM2 has launched its Operation Shamrock Plan, a set of initiatives which it says will facilitate essential workers in coming home to Ireland and address systemic barriers to the progress of those workers who've left this country and not returned. AIM2 leader is Deputy Pádraig Tobin. Good morning to you, Pádraig. Thanks so much for your time. Good to have you back on the show.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity.
Right. So, instantly, I'm thinking of the government plan to bring essential health workers home during the pandemic. Some of them responded. Not many got jobs. How does your plan different? How is it different?
Yeah, but I'm thinking back at that, and I think something like 70,000 essential health workers actually signed up to be on call for Ireland. And I think the government only employed about 450 of them, and that information was out of an AIM2 PQ. Ours is different. So, first of all, there's a serious problem. 34,700 people emigrated from Ireland last year. That's the highest figure since 2015, which was the austerity days. Secondly, we know that 13,000 nurses have left the country in the last 5 years. And a couple of years ago, the majority of graduating doctors left for Australia. And we know that this is happening at a time where there are major gaps within the health service, and this is causing damage to the delivery of the health service across the country. It's, I think, a very sad situation when you see so many people emigrate, especially when this country is meant to be awash with money, especially when we're meant to be awash with jobs.
So now, just in relation to the healthcare workers then, so, like, say, for an example, You know, there's an element of lifestyle, right? So you can go to Dubai or Australia or wherever. So you get to spread your wings a little bit, maybe with the intention of coming home, maybe not. But also the terms and conditions. And you see some of the ads for the recruitment of nurses, using them as an example, or even the Gardaí when the Canadians come over actively looking to hire Gardaí. They're very, very favourable. And you factor into that potentially, you know, life-work balance and good weather. Not wishing to poo-poo your proposals, but can we actually really compete with that?
Yeah, so there's two things in terms of health workers. First of all, in parts of Australia, it's mandated by law that the patient's medical professional ratio must be 1-4. So 4 patients for every medical professional, such as a nurse. In Ireland, in reality, there's no law. And in actual fact, it could be 1 nurse for every 8, 9, 10, or even 11 patients. So there's no doubt that the working conditions are a disaster for many nurses in this country compared to the likes of Australia. Secondly, Australia are offering up to $15,000 for nurses to relocate to Australia at the moment, while the HSE currently is only offering €4,700 for nurses to relocate back home. So there's two things. If you want to make sure that nurses feel confident that they're coming back to a functional health service, you have to make sure that the money follows the actions in the health service, so that hospitals get paid for the number of operations, engagements, therapies, as such, and that we get money to the front line and we don't get money lost within administration. Secondly, we have a plan to reduce the healthcare professional patient ratio significantly, and we want to spend €24 million over a space of each year to reduce that patient ratio down and to give people confidence. But the third issue is also housing, and the fact that so many young people can't either afford to rent or buy housing in this country. And what we're looking to do in relation to that is build 2,000 houses a year for healthcare professionals and construction workers in the LDA system, with planning exemptions, so that they can be built faster and cheaper. And for many years in Ireland, you know, there was housing built for doctors, for nurses, for Gardaí, for specific
what would stop me? So as a newly qualified nurse, then, what would stop me saying, right, it's actually more advantageous for me to move to Australia, work for a couple of years, come back here, get, you know, potential quick access to a house, and 12K in my back pocket?
Well, first of all, I will say that if you're a newly qualified nurse, the biggest reason you're probably looking to leave at the moment is the chaos and dysfunction in the health service. So Operation Shamrock looks to target that. So that would reduce the necessity for a person to leave. Secondly, obviously, you know, in terms of our housing policy, our policy is to get rid of the VAT on construction of houses at the moment, which would take €50,000 off the price of a house.
But how do you stop nurses heading abroad, or builders heading abroad to come back, because they can have a 2-week life experience somewhere else, or 2-year, sorry, life experience somewhere else, and come back to this more advantageous situation?
I take your point. There's a danger that someone could game the system, and they could surf the incentives on both sides of the pond in terms of this.
So how do you counteract that?
But in reality, what you would... The reason why these nurses are going, and the conversations that we're having with nurses, is because of the absolute disaster within the health service. Mm. So the incentive to leave reduces when you start to focus and fix on that. In terms of counteracting that, you know, we're looking at a situation where people would be in Australia or Canada for 5 years at least, to participate.
So it would be the returning nurses that would get access to these 2,000 properties in the 12K. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, returning nurses, doctors, and construction workers.
How is that fair to newly qualified nurses that choose to stay and enter that health system and work in it? Doesn't seem very fair.
I'll be honest with you, Greg. There is a prodigal son element to this. So you can have a situation where you say, okay, if we don't give an incentive to people to come home, we just have to remain static and we have to sit in our hands and there's no movement on this. And I think all of your listeners will understand that if we want people to come home, we have to give an incentive. And to give an incentive means we have to make it economically worthwhile in terms of the payment for flights and to make sure that they settle down into accommodation in Ireland. And we have to say to them, we want to house you when you get home.
Just really seems unfair. It just seems, I'm not trying to pick holes in the pattern. It just seems really unfair to those who, in fact, what it sounds to me like, if I were a newly qualified nurse, the first thing I'd be doing is booking a flight somewhere else because I'm less valued than the prodigal son.
Yeah, well, you would, that decision will be made without proper analysis and research. The proper analysis and research is telling you people are not going in a purpose to game the system. People are going not necessarily for the attractions that the Australian Health Service provides in terms of their incentives. People are going because there is a dysfunction within the health service. Simon Harris, when he was Minister for Health himself, initiated a research document that showed that the reasons why there are so many accidents happening on hospital wards at the moment is because of the fact that there is such a poor healthcare professional to patient ratio. Nurses are going, most nurses want to stay here. Most doctors want to stay here. Most construction workers want to stay here. And their families do too. They want to be able to raise their families and to live in this country. They're being driven out of this country by two reasons. They're being driven by the dysfunction within the health service and the cost of housing. So our objective is twofold. You know, our objective in making sure that the money goes to the action will improve the health service for both returnee and the person who remains here. So it is
that's the level playing field. It's when it comes to the incentives to return that the playing field becomes skewed.
Well, can I ask you a question here? For example, if you're a nurse on a ward at the moment in Letterkenny Hospital, okay, and someone says to you, "We're going to give an incentive for nurses to come home to Ireland," and they think to themselves, "Well, that would mean instead of me looking after 12 nurses tomorrow, I'll have 12 patients tomorrow. I'll have to look after 8 patients tomorrow. My job will be more sustainable as a result of this." So there is a net benefit for people.
But if I were just taking up my job and I walked into the canteen and to my right was a nurse with a lovely tan or whatever, because they'd been in Australia for 2 years, that have €12,000 in the back pocket and access to a house. And I'd be sitting there because I stayed at home with no 12K, and probably at the back of the housing waiting list because I'm the squeezed middle, the working poor.
First of all, it's important to say that the 12K can only be drawn down if a person remains in that role for 5 years. And I can bet your bottom dollar, there's no doubt in my mind, Greg, if you tell nurses working within the system that you will have extra staff helping you on a daily basis,
you wouldn't get the 12K unless you were 5 years at home.
Yeah, no, for sure. You're not going to get the 12K unless you remain within that sector for 5 years.
Right. So that sounds even less attractive.
So how it works in other jurisdictions is the money is given out over a period of time. It's front-loaded. And if the person leaves that role after a period of time, they have to return the whole chunk as well. But like, here's a crisis. Right now at the moment, we have 107,000 adverse incidents that are happening in hospitals on an annual basis. 500 people are losing their lives in health service because of the accidents that are happening at the moment. The government has spent €2.25 billion on compensation just in a 10-year period within the health service because of the accidents that are happening. And nurses and doctors are voting with their feet and they're leaving this jurisdiction for others because of that dysfunction. And we have a shocking situation. We're spending hundreds of thousands of euros educating doctors, educating nurses. And as soon as they qualify, they are leaving this jurisdiction. Yeah. And that is a sin in terms of the waste of money, but also the waste of opportunity in terms of those people being able to live their lives here. And at Christmas time, many people in Donegal will have an empty chair around their dinner table because their loved one is in Australia and in Canada. And their loved ones, children's, are doing their holy communions and their confirmations and their graduations in another country. And those grandparents hardly ever get to see them.
I think
we're looking to do is reverse that.
Yeah, and I think it's a little bit different up here, as you'd be well aware, Patter, because, of course, you know, you're talking about our health service catching up with the international situation. The problem we have here is, like, Letterkenny University Hospital is so far behind the national situation. We rely incredibly heavy on locums because we can't get consultants to come up and work here. Inexplicably, really, other than some very debatable reasons, Sligo's been located as a surgical hub location without Letterkenny even being invited to apply for that. Compared to comparable hospitals, the amount of money we have per 100 per 1,000 patients is millions upon millions below the likes of Sligo University Hospital. In this year alone, 2025, Donegal's had a 35 million euro investment in the 2025 HSC capital plan from a 1.33 billion euro budget. So we're getting 0.3% of the budget, and yet we've got 3.2% of the population. So like we're regionally trying to catch up that I struggle to sort of buy into sort of the national thing. Well, but that's you're a national politician and I'm a regional journalist.
I do have sympathy in cases of Letterkenny, because believe it or not, Navan Hospital would be in a similar situation. And Navan Hospital was earmarked for closure of its A&E 10 years ago. And because of the fight we put up, we've managed to keep the A&E. And the problem is that the likes of Letterkenny and Navan, and my understanding is that they're not training hospitals, and as such, they're finding it difficult to get consultants and junior doctors to locate into those areas, and therefore you have a lot of locums. And the situation is a lot of those locums are actually doctors that were trained in other countries and other jurisdictions. And you know, it's quite incredible that we are filling our hospitals with doctors who are trained in other jurisdictions while our own doctors are going abroad. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense. And you know, the right now, 51% of all undergraduates in the Irish medical schools are actually students from outside of the EU. And the reason that's the case is because the schools need their money to be able to function. But the problem is that most of those doctors, when they graduate, will go home.
Yeah.
And we're left with a massive gap in the number of doctors.
Now, you were talking, it's not just the health service, it's other essential workers, but it's just that seems most pertinent to us here at the moment.
Construction workers, I think, is another key issue, given obviously the housing crisis and the mica crisis in Donegal as well. You know, just give an example, the government, in terms of trying to attract back construction workers in the last 5 years, has spent about 170,000 euros. All that added up to was a social media campaign. When we asked them how many construction workers came home to Ireland as a result of that campaign, they didn't know. Mm. Even when we asked in terms of health workers around how many people availed of the 4,700 euros returning fee, the HSE didn't know. There's a complete lack of information in terms of this. The government don't mean business in terms of bringing people home. And in terms of construction, you know, there's obviously, we could speak for an hour on the problems happening within the construction industry. But two major issues are the lack of workers and also construction inflation. And the lack of workers actually feeds into construction inflation.
Of course, but also too, like, you know, it is, and I've been saying this for years, it's not that I'm very, it's infrastructure. You know, a big swathe of Donegal currently under a hose pipe ban. It doesn't have enough water to facilitate any new development. Yeah. And there's many other areas on the brink of actually having no water.
I had Ishka Aaron in with me in front of the infrastructure committee there 2 weeks ago in Leinster House. I asked them, I said, when will you fill the gaps in the water infrastructure system that are currently blocking the building of houses? And they said they will have the gaps filled in 2050.
All right, terrible. So finally, quick reaction.
Before they're going to have those gaps filled.
It's crazy.
Before housing can be built. It's just incredible.
Quick reaction. What do you think of Sinn Féin's new proposal to allow people in the North vote in presidential elections? A good idea. You could hop on that one.
It's an excellent idea. We have our own bill.
I know, I'm being facetious.
So I'm glad that Sinn Féin have done it. I'm glad that they have kind of woken up again to these issues. We've worked hard on it. We've put our own bill into the Leinster House. It was just, you know, we asked Mary Lou, and would she sign the bill? Because we wanted it to be a cross-party bill. But unfortunately, Sinn Féin didn't come back to us. And I will say this to your Sinn Féin listeners. you know, these issues are bigger than any one political party, and, you know, petty political differences or bitterness. Yeah,
but everyone wants, it's like counter motions. Everyone wants their sort of name at the top of the bill. Sure. Very finally, are yous backing anyone or chatting to anyone about potential candidacy for the election, or are you in discussions with other, you know, to get the critical mass required to propose a candidate?
We would like to run our own candidate, but there is a difficulty there. We're talking to people within the Oireachtas around signatures. You have to have 20 Oireachtas members to be able to nominate.
Is there a candidate you could get behind if you couldn't meet your own sort of...
Yeah, we are definitely willing. There's about two candidates have already contacted us, and we are weighing up the pros and cons in relation to that. We have an Ord Cóirle meeting this Saturday. We're meeting in Bowdenstown in Kildare for a commemoration for Wolfe Tone, and then our Ord Cóirle meeting is happening. And after our Ord Cóirle meeting, we'll have a decision on the two people who have already asked us to back their campaigns. But we would definitely support a campaign of a candidate that represents, you know, our objectives and our policies.
All right. Listen, thanks for all of your time. Take care of yourself. That's the N2 leader there, Pádraig Tobin. What do you think of those proposals? I mean, it's a nice idea, but... I want to know what you think. All right, let's say good morning now to Councillor Dennis McGee of the 100% Redress Party. Good morning, Dennis. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning.
It's good to have you on the show. Right, okay, interesting. We've seen sort of town teams pop up around different parts of the county, developing plans, discussing the future and so on and so forth. And we're seeing some progress in towns off the back of that. And you are wondering if anyone might be interested in getting involved in a similar initiative for Falkara.
Yeah, well, I mean, tonight we have our third meeting and in probably the last 2 months when it comes to this year. And first of all, I have to give a big shout out to Patricia McIntyre. She's the town regeneration officer within Donegal County Council. And I remember reaching out to her, watching how town teams were being set up in the likes of Glenties, Buncrana, Creasla. And I thought, wow, brilliant idea, like, you know, because it kind of acts as an umbrella over all, you know, all the local little committees, like, and it brings them all under the one roof.
And Dennis, traditionally, I mean? How these work, then the umbrella group, the town team, then sort of then has further public meetings so that everybody with an interest in Falkara gets to feed into certain questionnaires about the future, the facilities, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not necessarily the small team that make these calls. They then facilitate a wider public engagement about the future of Falkara. Is that the same pattern being followed here?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the vital part of it, like that nobody is left behind. Do you know what I mean? All the organisations get to feed into this here, and it's about the people, like. And what do the people want for, you know, Falkara, the greater Clonmany area? Do you know? So, like, let that be like the youth of Falkara or the Clonmany area. There's so much to offer there, like, you know, because we're part of the Gaeltacht. You know, we have the golf club there. We have the GAA. You know, the tourism. You'll have to go through Falkara if you want to take that coast road over along that Wild Atlantic Way. So there's so much. But the main thing is we need all the stakeholders, you know, everybody, you know, to show an interest here now, like, you know, because
and for those
hopefully
who may not be, for those who may not be aware too, eventually, hopefully, a town plan is developed. And then with the support of the council, there's different various funding streams. It could be the development of a play park, a greenway or whatever. You know, it's whatever is actually most relevant to the area. And it allows the people of Falkara to have their sort of say on that direction. So tonight's meeting, then, it's still a shout out for anyone who might be interested in forming this town team, being part of this umbrella group. So when and where, Dennis?
So it's on in the Chanvarig tonight at 8 p.m. And it would be great to see, you know, loads of people there. Like, now we have had two meetings and there is good interest, like, you know, but it's important to get a little plug in here now today to just remind people to come out, because we don't want to move forward and leave anybody behind, like, you know. So this is like a call out to every, because everybody's welcome, like, you know. Yeah. This is about the youth, the future of Clonealy, Fulcara in general, like, you know, and what the people want. I think that's the main message.
All right, then. Thanks for that, Dennis. Take care of yourself, Councillor Dennis McGee there. Get along to that if you're in the area. Some reaction coming in to Patato Bean. What nonsense, says one listener. What about all the people that are at home working hard? Why don't we care for them instead of trying to take people home? We need to appreciate who is already here working. And I think part of their plan also, as reference, would be to make the working environment in hospitals better for those that are here. Whether that came to pass or not. All doctors and nurses should be contractually obliged to work for 5 years in Ireland before they can even emigrate. That's an interesting one. It comes up from time to time and there are varying views in relation to that. But if you are, you know, I mean, there's a lot of expense on behalf of the student, but the state puts up quite a bit too. And it's a tricky one. The politicians don't want to get involved in that one because there's very mixed views in relation to it. A caller says we should also pay workers with more experience more than newly qualified workers. Experience, they say, is invaluable. Another, don't blame student nurses and doctors leaving Ireland, as the grass is definitely greener on the other side as far as the social and career opportunities that are there. Maybe it should be that all trained here sign a contract to give back at least 2 years in our hospitals before travelling abroad. See, one's an incentive and one's sort of part of your training process. You know, you start sort of getting involved in the latter there, it could be complicated. Greg, we should ensure that our very well-educated staff are obliged to remain in the health service for some years post-registration. This would certainly ease the problem and enhance the experience. Interesting, because that never really came up in the conversation, but quite a number of you are suggesting that newly qualified healthcare professionals, if I'm reading it correctly, should be obliged to work here for a period of time. Another caller says it's not going to happen. You won't get the 12,000 unless you are in the nursing sector for 5 years. I think it's pie in the sky, like everything else in Ireland. Plenty of money, but none of the Irish citizens are seeing any of it. If I were part of the AIM2 sort of policy people sitting around a table on that one, I'm not sure I'd have signed off on it, if I'm honest with you. I'm a healthcare assistant for over 12 years and I'm struggling to build my home here in Donegal. I'm entitled to nothing. I've been through the tough times in Ireland. I've also done my time in Australia and came home with a few bob. Why are they making a difference? Any word when water will be back on again in Carndonagh? Let me check in on the next break on that, see if I can find any information for you. Back to the issue of that circular that went out in relation to certain children in certain schools being moved into mainstream schools, special classes, etc. Louise joins me on the programme now on this topic. Louise, thanks for your time this morning.
Good morning, Greg, and thank you for facilitating the call.
All right. Your reaction to the redesignation of special schools, what do you believe the impact of such a move might be?
Well, I was stunned to read it and just to see that at this stage of the year, that this would be information that parents and schools would be receiving. And it makes it very difficult to mobilise a movement when we have so little time to prepare. I just think that this type of initiative is actually going to lead to the exclusion of a very vulnerable group of students.
Do you think this sort of categorisation of children as well, you know, because it's not everyone's affected by this, and on the face of it, you know, mild this and mild that, it might sound like better inclusion. You know, as I say, unless you're acutely aware or directly affected, I'm just wondering if the general population might be looking at this just a quick read and going, oh, this sounds right. Yeah, this is exactly what we should be doing. But it doesn't really, you know, these labels don't necessarily, it's not really quite that simple.
No, that's exactly it. You know, this, the word mild, there's nothing mild in the learning and educational experience of children with mild general learning difficulties. You know, it's not a one size fits all, but their educational experience has been very, very difficult for them. And, you know, there's not a parent in the country, Greg, who, when they're having a new baby that was welcomed into the life, they go, I really hope this child is going to struggle and things are going to be difficult for them. You know, we all want the best for our children. But the mild label, there is nothing mild about it. Many children that attend mild general learning difficulty schools have to have, they have to have a mild intellectual difficulty, but many have co-occurring other conditions like epilepsy, autism, ADHD, mobility issues, neurological issues. There's all sorts of things. So there's nothing mild about it. And I think the understanding generally people think, oh, if it's mild, should they be grand? They'll be grand. They can go off to the local school and the SNA can pop in and out to them and they'll be grand. But that really isn't the experience. And my fear, and my child would be included in this category, is that there will be an educational cleansing of a very vulnerable group of children. Because although they have mild general learning difficulties, if they are displaced from an environment which facilitates and celebrates their type of learning, they will stop presenting in school and people will think, well, mild general learning difficulty, it's not that big a deal.
Well, also something that came up yesterday in the conversation, and I didn't have the time to dig into it, was sort of mild general learning disabilities. So in the St. Bernadette situation, the children with the children classified MGLD would be moved into mainstream schools, and it seems the plan then would be to move children with more complex needs into the likes of St. Bernadette's, right? So that is, it's almost creating, I don't know how I would describe it, but it's almost as if a parent could say, well, that's my place because my child needs it more than your child. Your child's good enough for a mainstream school. My child needs it. And that's kind of unsettling for me. It feels a little unsettling.
For me, it's a very divisive move because I love my child and I'm going to help protect his educational setting because there will be nothing mild about my response to helping meet his needs where they're at. But it sets parents of children with special educational needs apart. And it sets us against each other because one person would think, well, should they be grand? They can go off to the local comp. My child needs it more. When parents of children with special educational needs, we need to mobilise and we need to be united in this together and not be set apart from each other. And children shouldn't, it's not the responsibility of children with special educational needs to provide spaces for other children with special educational needs to attend school. That's the responsibility on the government. It is not on some of our most vulnerable students. And my real concern, and I'm a teacher for 23 years, and we moved up to Donegal because this was an exceptional school that could meet the needs of our child. Because not all children can thrive educationally in all environments. And my real concern is that children with mild general learning difficulties will become educational refugees. They will be displaced from their educational setting, forced into unsuitable educational settings, and there will be simply trauma from that. There will be school refusal, there will be anxiety, there will be depression. And then people will think the mild general learning, should they were grand, but the child will present with other problems because their inability to cope and the stressful environment.
Louise, I think also we have a bit of a window here because everyone I've spoken to so far, like yourself, has a child who is in St. Bernadette Special School, but also a lot of the parents I spoke to yesterday, their experience was their child... The children were in mainstream schools and were everything that you've described happening actually was happening to them. They were falling behind, hiding books that were 2 years behind their peers in the same classroom. Then they moved to St. Bernadette's and thrived and excelled and exceeded even the performances of some of their peers. Now, you're coming at this with great knowledge, Louise, and the parents I spoke to yesterday were as well. But we're very trusting, and we trust the HSE, and we trust the Education Board, and I'm just thinking on, you know, parents who will get a diagnosis, an MGLD diagnosis of their child in this year or next year or the year after or after this circular is enforced, and they'll be told that the best thing for their children is a special class in a mainstream school, and they won't know. They won't know. They will have nothing to compare or no experience. And maybe your opinion might be lost at that point. You know what I mean? Because you've had your say.
Yeah.
And there'll be a whole generation. It might take a generation or two before we all cop on again that we absolutely knew what we were doing was right. Does that make sense? It sounds a bit...
That makes absolute sense. I would, for me as a parent and as a teacher, I would see that the mild general learning difficulty label is under threat. Because the children will be displaced and they will start to be labelled as having other behaviours. That's why they're not engaging in school. They will fall through the cracks. And parents will be under pressure because they'll say, oh, well, you know, the child is on the borderline mild. Maybe if we apply a bit of pressure, we get a private assessment. Maybe it'll go towards more of a moderate. There'll be a better educational setting for them then. And then again, it's when you misdiagnose the needs of a child, you misdiagnose the learning needs, the social development needs. And the impact of a dysfunctional educational system is a lifelong impact on any child. And it continues on into adulthood. Any of us can think back to things that happened in school that upset us or shaped us. You can see the trauma of previous generations of how education was handled and the trauma that it had. And we are looking at this as a group of children who will be intellectually cleansed. This will stop existing.
But we really need to make sure, us as a society and as a collective responsibility here, we really need to take a pause now that this is in the public domain and make sure that what we're doing is right for all children. Because this will it'd be very difficult to undo. Because the schools will no longer be there, the expertise will no longer be there, the children will be falling behind, they maybe have behavioural problems, they become adults and might not function as well in society as they might.
Exactly.
And that could be 18 years down the line. So it really, I think it's important that we all make sure right now, and I've said this about other issues in education, that we all take a pause here and make sure for all children that we're making the right decision now. Because as I say, to put this genie back in the bottle down the line will be impossible.
Yeah, and these are real children with real life experiences who want the best opportunities at life. And I will say, from my experience, professionally and personally, St. Bernadette's and schools that are tailor-made and tailor-built to meet the learning needs of their students, the impact they have on that child is unbelievable. And it allows them access to school, access to education, access to employment, because they have the life skills, they've learned at a pace that's appropriate and adequate, and it's unleashed all this creativity and magic in these children who have always felt less than.
Yeah.
Kind of like other children, but on the edge. And they are a bigger risk of bullying, of mental health issues, of trauma, of depression, anxiety and school refusal, because they have always felt other than. And every parent wants their child to thrive in school. Okay. And it would be handy if every child could go to the local school up the road. But if that's not meeting the child's needs, that's where the issue is. And
Louise,
it's up to the government to provide these places, not to say to some children, you're just not.
Yeah.
You're just not special enough.
All right.
It's just totally unacceptable. Sorry.
No. Listen, it's so important what you're saying, and I maybe I can't do it now because of time. I wouldn't mind speaking to you maybe if you had an insight too. Is the impact on the wider school population as well? I mean, is this
for sure
the right decision for students in mainstream schools? You know,
and that's a definite conversation that needs to be had.
Because of resources being limited, resources being. But directed elsewhere. Do you want a minute on that, Louise?
Yeah, sure, no problem. Yeah,
go on. Just go. Give us a minute because I open till 11. What could be the broader impact then on school life?
The broader impact will be that children with mild general learning difficulties, and with their co-occurring addition conditions, their places are going to be subject to yearly review. So if your child is doing really well, your child is at risk of not staying in a mild school. So the broader issues with the educational experience will be that mainstream schools will absorb, and sorry to use that word, the children with mild general learning difficulties to open up the spaces for children with more complex needs. So within the mainstream school setting, and this is for every parent out there who has a child that attends a mainstream setting, the access that your child is receiving now to an SNA or to a resource teacher, that will be limited. Because the demographic within the school, the educational demographic within the school will change. The same amount of resource teachers, same amount of resource areas, SNAs, but because the demographic will change, the resources
the student
will
population
be
profile
further.
Changes. Okay, brilliant.
The student population profile changes.
Brilliant explanation. Thank you. Very, very important, Louise. Thank you so very much indeed.